Hi, you're listening to What's the Schemata, a schema therapy podcast for therapists. With ISST accredited schema therapy supervisors and trainers, Chris Hayes and Rob Brockman. For more information on schema therapy, visit our website, schematherapytraining.com.
Hi everyone, and welcome to What's the Schemata. I'm here with Dr. Robert Brockman, and today we're joined with special guest Alyssa Garrett, who's a clinical psychologist based in Perth, in Western Australia. And today's topic is how schema therapists can become more neurodiversity affirming in their practice. So Alyssa, welcome to What's the Schemata? We were just talking before that we're recording on the day that Taylor Swift is releasing her album. So hopefully our internet doesn't break and it stays connected.
So Alyssa, why don't you say a few things about yourself? If you can introduce yourself and where you practice and a little bit about how you got into neurodiversity affirming therapy.
Sure. So my name is Alyssa Garrett. I'm dialing in from Whadjuk Noongarrpuja in Perth. I'm a clinical psychologist. I've been working in the field for about 18 years and have a private practice called Neurodiversity Haven Psychology.
No.
And we know each other. We were in a supervision relationship a couple of years ago, weren't we?
So, declarations, people.
Yeah. So we just need to.
That's right.
Might be very familiar.
I've been working primarily in the schema therapy area for around about 5 years. It's been my key therapeutic modality, and had the privilege of being under Chris's supervision for a couple of years. That has really formed the foundation for how I. So you might recognize that in the way that I talk about schema therapy. And my other area of expertise is ACT.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great. Fantastic.
All right. So let's get straight into it. Alyssa, what exactly is neurodiversity affirming therapy, and why is it important?
Sure. So I should probably add in terms of my background that in addition to my schema therapy training, the last couple of years I've been working really intensively in the area of neurodiversity affirming therapy. And the reason for that is because I was finding that lots and lots of my clients where we were heavily engaged in schema therapy and they were finding that really helpful, but the progress was slower or different from what we might expect. It turned out that a lot of my clients were undiagnosed neurodivergent, and more specifically ADHD and or autism. And so based on that, I saw it as important to really delve into understanding what did these different neurotypes mean. It's also been in the last few years that I've discovered my own neurodivergence. So I proudly identify as autistic ADHD. And within the field of neurodiversity affirming practice, it's really important that we are listening to and prioritizing the voices of lived experience. And so for anyone listening today, it helps, I think, to understand what is the context that I'm bringing. And I see my own lived experience as the best credential that I have to talk in the neurodiversity affirming space.
Yeah.
And now coming back to your question, which interestingly, part of different neurodivergent communication styles is a tendency to wander off from the point. So I'll be trying to stay on track, but Chris and Rob, please do feel free to be back in line and remind me of what the question was.
You'll be fine.
I do remember though, the question was, what is neurodiversity affirming practice? So this is basically, it's a therapeutic application of a theoretical and a conceptual shifting in our practice. Neurodiversity affirming practice is based on the unfaltering assumption that diversity amongst humans is normal, it's valid, and it's also important. Okay, so what is normal amongst humans is diversity. And we need to have brains that work differently in order to contribute to advancement and variety of different things that our society needs. So from that fundamental assumption that difference is normal, valid, and important, everything else will flow from that, including the therapeutic environment, the therapist mindset, and the therapist's interactional style, the way that we assess, and also the way that we intervene with our clients.
Do you see it sort of like a strengths and weaknesses kind of mindset? Is that how you would view?
Could you explain what do you mean?
Well, I guess in terms of, you know, people have different strengths and weaknesses in different domains in terms of, you know, sort of, intellectual information processing, for example. Is that how you might view it? Yeah. Tell us more.
We might do, but as part of neuroaffirming practice, we tend to stay away from words like weakness because they tend to buy into ableist expectations that permeate our society about. Because when we use words like weakness, we're making assumptions about, well, what is the standard? What is the expected amount of strength or weakness in a particular area? So it could potentially fit within that, but the language that we tend to focus on much more is difference.
Difference.
So we're looking not at what is a weakness, what is an impairment, what is a disorder even. Yeah. We're looking at what the differences. And when differences being a much more neutral word, we're really emphasizing that sense that if someone has a strength in this particular area and say weakness in this area, that's not a good thing or a bad thing. It's just a thing.
So do you see many challenges with therapists, you know, challenges within themselves of being more neurodiversity affirming?
Yes, I do. So the work that myself and my colleagues are involved in the neurodiversity affirming schema therapy space, it really comes from our sense of purpose, I guess, that neurodiversity affirming practice makes a really significant difference to the clients that we're working with. And when we don't apply that particular lens, at best, we might see the therapy as being unhelpful. But in some cases, it can actually be harmful. So your question is about what, are you asking what prevents therapists from being more affirming?
Why aren't therapists more affirming generally? What stops them from being naturally adopting this approach?
Because on some level, I think it makes sense. Everyone wants to affirm their clients. And you know, to some degree, this might be a slightly new lens. Maybe that's a part of it. But, you know, why is it that we're all not out there adopting this lens already?
Yes. Yeah, that's a great question. And I think the best answer I could give is to say we don't know what we don't know. Okay. So I reckon it's a pretty safe assumption that anyone who's listening to this podcast is really interested in caring for their clients to the best of their ability, and that they are doing that from a perspective of being open, curious, and non-judgmental. So that is a pretty safe assumption. But what we don't realize without training in neurodiversity affirming practice is that usually when we are being open and non-judgmental and generally affirming, we are doing that with implicit ableist assumptions about what is and isn't expected and outcomes. So what I'm getting at there is that the society that we live in is based on neurotypical norms. So neurotypical being what is the most typical or average ways that brains develop and function. And we cannot escape the way that those assumptions permeate our understanding and expectations within the world. And that might come down to simple things like how should a client greet you when they come into the Or what does it mean if they're fidgeting or not holding eye contact and so on? So we will typically make assumptions about that behavior based on our expectations of what is the correct amount of eye contact, for example. When we step outside of and we step into understanding the lived experience and valid differences for a neurodivergent individual, then we start to understand that what we thought meant when they did A, B, or C may be different from what it actually means.
It's sort of helping with attunement in some ways, isn't it? You're sort of attuning to the experience rather than going with your own expectations, going, oh, look, you know, if you're talking to Joe Blow, you're making an assumption about X, Y, Z, you're getting in a deeper level of attunement. Yeah.
100%. Yeah. Yeah. And so that sense of attunement is really what attracted me to schema therapy in the first place. It's fundamental to the schema therapy model that we attune to the client's needs. What we do slightly differently within a neurodiversity affirming schema framework is we recognize that to really attune, to really meet the needs of our neurodivergent clients, we need to step outside of our own neurotypical expectations and step in to what does it really mean for this client when they say, I'm anxious, or it's too loud, or it's too much, or I can't do it.
So this is the thing, like, because the social world, as you point out, is neurotypical in terms of the norming, right? Because if a kid's in a classroom and then little Johnny comes to class and all the kids are sort of establishing a baseline of norm, right, about eye contact, about different things. So this averaging thing that you talk about is something that's going on all the time in life, implicitly, explicitly, and then folks have to live in that world. And then, of course, this is impacting folks. And this is forming schemas. It's impacting whether people are getting their needs met.
Yes. And so in terms of that schema development, well, it makes sense if your innate preference for how to interact with your environment, the automatic way that you are processing information, if the messaging you're receiving around that is that you're doing it wrong or you're failing to meet that standard, then it's pretty understandable that there are going to be some schemas that develop from there.
Yeah. Is it okay to say things like, well, just in your view, of course, everything I say, when I say, is it okay, I mean in your view, you know, I often would come at it from an angle because I would notice with certain clients who are autistic, for example, that they really struggle with something like social cognition, sort of automatically understanding social interactions, and that's a big part of their struggle, for example. Is it okay to acknowledge those things, that they are typically struggling in those situations? I guess I get in a zone where I'm worrying, am I tripping up? You know, am I not being neuroaffirming in discussing certain problems they experience?
It's a great question, and I think it's so important that for all of us as therapists that we are questioning ourselves, is it all right that I am interacting in this way, that I'm presenting information in a certain way? I think that ongoing self-reflection is so important. To answer your question, I think it's helpful to mention that the neurodiversity affirming paradigm is based on the social model of disability. And the social model of disability argues that a disability does not exist within the individual. So the person themselves is not the problem. And so going from that, social differences themselves are not the problem. The problem exists within the environment. It exists within an environment that is ill-suited to the way the individual is in this world. And so based on that, when it comes to what we might in a neurotypical framework consider as social problems, we would say that there is a mismatch between the client's communication style and the environment in which they're trying to communicate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then adding to that, talk about the double empathy problem, which is developing body research that talks about how autistic individuals actually can be great at communicating socially. And when I say great, what I mean is they can have conversations that flow really well, are reciprocal, all of those sorts of things that we might look for when they are talking to another autistic person. And the problem only occurs when the autistic person is talking to a neurotypical person. And then equally what we have learned is that neurotypical people have the same kind of difficulty communicating and understanding the communication of an autistic person. So in other words, the problem goes both ways. Autistic people have trouble communicating with neurotypical people, speaking on average.
So what you say is like it's not a case of, it's not a case of one is better than the other. It's just a difference. And the difference shows up in the context, which either way you go. Yeah, yeah.
That's okay. Right. And so our society, when we talk about neurotypical norms and expectations, we're talking about ableism. And ableism is the assumption that one way of being or one way of communicating, for example, is superior to another.
I understand.
And so instead, we're looking, so when it comes to talking to your client, Rob, about social problems, we would be looking at, okay, what's your communication style? Okay, so one common example that comes up is that autistic people generally do not enjoy small talk. It's not interesting to them. They much prefer to talk about things and communication tends to be based on sharing of information or sharing of interest.
Yeah.
So we would look at what's your communication style and what's happening when you're interacting with this person? Something isn't, you know, something's not fitting too well. And then we look at, okay, what do you want to do with that?
Yeah. Understand. So, I mean, I guess in some ways, this ableist sort of paradigm, it's the dominant paradigm, let's say, in the world, right? Because people who have this normative approach. And where am I going with this? Well, I guess that the issue is partly then that many of the clients would come surrendering to that paradigm, you know, so they come in and describe their own problems as I'm bad at emotions or I'm bad at social interactions. So they actually come in self-describing this, surrendering to this idea. So this is a cool idea. Like listening to you, it makes a lot of sense. If I'm not wrong, part of what you'd be doing is helping them reinterpret actually their own view of themselves in a way that's more normative to say, well, that actually makes a lot of sense. You know, am I getting this?
Yes. Yep. I think you've relayed that really nicely. And so the way that might show up as a general sort of intervention approach, the client is likely to come in with a sense, there is something wrong with me. And what we can look at in therapy in a neurodiversity affirming framework is, look, there is nothing wrong with you. You are fine. You are great just the way you are. But there is something different about you. Mm. And that difference is valid and important, not something we want to change, but it's going to mean that there's going to be some challenges when it comes to interacting with an environment that was not designed for you.
Yeah. So the inner critic must be really involved in this. Like with the way you're talking, you know, it in the schema model, we would call that some version of the critic. Could you say some things about that, about the involvement of the critic for many of these folks and whether you have a different view of the critic or, I mean, how does it show up? I don't know.
Yes. So my colleagues and I, there's a group of five psychologists from Perth that have developed an approach to schema therapy that's called Stand Attuned, which is schema therapy at divergence. And then that word attuned because that's the center of what we do. And That is a comprehensive approach to working with neurodivergent clients within a schema therapy framework. And within that model, when we talk about the critic, we've labeled that as ableist critic. And the reason that we've done that is because we recognize that such a big part of the issues that our clients were dealing with related to those ableist notions about there being a correct or superior way of being in the world. So that is something that we work with a lot, but there is something that we have separated out from the critic, and that is something that we call the neurotypical advisor. And Rob, this actually reminds me a lot of when you talk about the functional critic and when that critical side seems to have an adaptive value. What we were finding in working with neurodivergent clients is that when we tried to challenge their critic, there was a lot of pushback. Change was very slow. I can specifically remember hearing from a number of my clients something to the effect of, absolutely not. I will not be putting that critic aside. I need that.
Yeah.
And I wonder how many of us could relate to that experience of a client who really doesn't want to lose that critical side of themselves. And so what we proposed was that separate from that critical mode, we have an advisor self. So the neurotypical advisor is picking up on all of the social norms and expectations that you have been enculturated with from a very young age. So things like when you're in a social situation, you're expected to make eye contact, to make small talk, to make your facial expressions match your words, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And therefore, if you don't behave in that way, and people might think that you're weird or unusual or rude or any number of things,
as
there'll be consequences.
Sorry to interrupt.
A coping, did you
say? Yeah. Would you say that it's a coping mode? Or,
did you ask if it?
Yeah. Sorry. Would you see that as a coping
mode? We can perhaps put that to the side and we'll come back to that in a sec. So with that advice, the really important thing that we emphasize is that information is neutral. These are the expectations. These are the consequences if you don't meet the expectations, or possible consequences, I should say. That is neutral and helpful information. The client does need that, because if you don't naturally keep up on what are the forms and expectations, then you need this explicit learning.
So that feels almost like a version of a healthy adult, actually, if I'm not wrong, that... You know, it's the critic when you've converted it to something more healthy, more like data than critical.
That's not the way that we conceptualize it. However, it's worth noting, I think, that the stage of our work is yet to be empirically validated. So, and in terms of where these different modes fit and how they fit into the wider established schema therapy model, that's still under consideration. So we can talk about the healthy adult and the coping in just a sec, but if I can just come back to that ableist critic for a minute. So if we think about that neurotypical advisor, the ableist critic listens carefully to the advisor and turns that into how the client should be behaving. So if the expectation is that you behave in this way, that's what you need to do. And if you don't, then you're weird or you're stupid or all those things that a critic might say. So that's the way that we think about the critic. And I really want to emphasize that has been a game changer for the clients that we see in validating, I can see how helpful this advisor self has been. This is helpful to you, and we'll listen to that, but we want to set some limits with the critic.
How interesting. The I don't see a lot of neurodiverse clients, but the ones that I have, that they've almost always had what I would call a super critic. The critic has just been like, you know, overbearing, you know. And on top of that, I've had the same experience I think that you've had, which is they've really connected to this idea of their critic being more functional or trying to help them in a way, having an underlying function and approaching it from that standpoint for me with those guys has always been much easier and better than the alternative.
Because you're the experience of a neurodivergent is so often that nobody understands, okay? So, Chris, if you're my therapist and you're telling me that, you know, I'm being too critical and I need to set limits with that critic, my assumption is likely to be Chris doesn't really understand. He doesn't know how this critic has helped me. And so thinking about Rob's approach with that sense of what is the function and recognizing and validating that, or in our model we talk about the neurotypical advisor, it's a way of connecting, and the client kind of stops fighting so much against
So I guess for myself, just trying to put it into my model, in my mind of where does it sit? Is it separate from a healthy adult, separate from a coping? Is it a separate entity for you?
At this stage, we see it as separate. But what I would emphasize at this stage is that we see it as separate based on what is clinically useful. So in our experience in working with these clients, when we separate that part out, the traction is high and it makes a big difference to the therapeutic progress. So in terms of how it sits conceptually, we don't see it as part of healthy adult. We see that the healthy adult's job is to oversee all of the modes. So to take information under advisement from the neurotypical advisor, listen to what are the expectations, and then listen to the whole child and look at what the coping modes are doing and then make an informed choice about
it. Does everyone have a neurotypical advisor?
That's an interesting question and one that I've thought about a fair amount. I would say that every neurodivergent client, and speaking specifically neurodivergence being ADHD and autism, and there are other forms of neurodivergence, but those are the ones that we've particularly focused on. So I would say that is common to all autistic and ADHD clients, again, because the social norms and expectations are explicitly learned rather than implicitly learned.
Yeah.
As to whether everyone else does, I don't feel that I'm qualified to comment, but I might argue that if it's implicit knowledge that you naturally get, then you probably don't need that itself to be providing that information.
Yeah, I mean, I can relate to the idea that there's a sort of a side of us that is telling you what is expected in the social context. Is that what you mean? Like, it's sort of saying, if you do this, you might be shunned. For example, is that the sort of it's information you're getting about what's expected in a typical scenario?
That would be part of it. Yes. So
can we flesh that out a little bit? Like, so this, what are some common neurotypical advisor when it's giving the message, or when it's active, what sort of messages would you hear, and how would that be different from when it goes to like inner critic?
Yeah.
So, just trying to think of an example. So what tends to come out in the therapy space is if a client comes in with an issue, you know, let's say I had a meeting with my boss at work and I messed it up. The meeting didn't go well. I'm so stupid. I should have done more prep, sort of thing. What we might do is some kind of moding out exercise, maybe with chairs, and we put the different modes into the chair and we'd ask things like, okay, so what is the neurotypical advisor telling you about the meeting? And what might come out is things like, well, when you're in a meeting, you're not supposed to say every second word, you're not supposed to lose your place or not know the answer to a question, you're supposed to, you know, speak clearly and eloquently and make eye contact and you're supposed to have done all of the research in advance for the meeting and whatever the things might be for that particular meeting. So those are social norms and expectations. And then there might be some sense of what are the consequences if you haven't met those expectations, that the boss might think you're not good at your job or not going to get that promotion or you're going to lose credibility or those things. And then we would say, okay, what's the ableist critic telling you about that? And that's where we'd hear, like, you're stupid. Why did you ever think you could be a whatever the job might be? You know, the sorts of things that a critic might say. And so what we would do in a situation like that is when we're setting limits with the critic, we want to be emphasizing there isn't just one way to communicate with your boss. Okay? There isn't just one way to show that you're competent. And some people are great and well-suited to face-to-face meetings, whereas other people have different interactional styles. So this information from the advisor about what's expected doesn't mean we have to follow that advice, because if we look at the wider context and we look at what is the client need, what are the client needs? So, for example, a lot of variation. The ability to communicate verbally. And so if that isn't the key competence for the client, it may be that we need to look at different accommodations in the workplace so that they can do their job well without being in situations that are ill-suited.
It's so interesting. Like the role of social context is so primary in this approach, isn't it? You know, and you're separating it out like that. It does remind me a bit of some of our work with Wendy as well. The converting the critic to the information. Like, it's okay to you know, sometimes the critic, it does, even it's the way it says it that's the problem. Underneath it, there's something that's not okay, or that, you know,
intention versus the impact.
You know,
I was going to also ask Alyssa, would you see the healthy adult mode being different in neuro, you know, diverse, you know, person?
The neuroaffirming affirming practice?
That.
In
the hard,
I think
hard
that there qualify. Are some value adds.
Yeah.
I think there are some value adds when we look at the healthy adult in a neuroaffirming schema framework. So in the standard tuned model, we have labelled the healthy adult as the neurodivergent healthy adult.
Yeah.
And the reason that we have that is a common experience for neurodivergent clients is that they grow up in families, not everyone, but for a number of people, they grow up in very well-intentioned families, right? So where the parents are doing their best to meet their kids' needs and to give them a good life. But what happens without that lack of neurodivergent attunement, so without recognizing that a neurodivergent child's needs are different and the way that those needs are best met is also different, then the needs are likely to go unmet. And so because of that, we thought it was important to emphasize that this is a neurodivergent healthy adult mode, and that healthy adult mode is going to tune in to the unique needs of the neurodivergent vulnerable child and all the ways that they experience the world and self-regulate, all of those things, is going to tune into that vulnerable child and pay attention to the neurotypical advisor and set limits with the critic.
Could you say something, Alyssa, about some of the, because this is really, really interesting now, because you're going into like more specific needs that we might see in neurodivergent people, you know, and yeah, could we speak to that? Because how can we meet the needs of these clients if we don't understand it?
Yeah. So core emotional needs are universal, independent type. We all have our core emotional needs. But the expression of those needs and the way that those needs are best responded to will be unique. And given neurodivergent differences with innate differences in temperament and neurobiology, that is going to have implications for the way that those needs are expressed and the way that they are best met. So that means that the likelihood of needs frustration is going to be higher, because if we're applying our neurotypical expectations as to how to care for a child, that a child's needs are different, then the likelihood of needs frustration will be higher. So an example of that would be thinking about a child who has sensory, maybe a child with tactile sensitivity, such that particularly if they're in a dysregulated state, the worst thing that you could do would be to touch them or to cuddle them, because increase the distress rather than decrease the distress. And so the need for emotional nurturance is the same for any child. We all need to be emotionally nurtured, but the way that that need is best met will be in ways where there isn't necessarily that physical contact.
So it's almost a moment of attunement where you're thinking, well, you know, with person A, I would typically do X, Y, Z, but being more affirming and more aware, you might hold back and go, what do they really need? Coherent and consistent with how they're made.
Do you believe that, and I know you said that needs are universal and we started from that point of view, are there specific needs though that are unique to people who are neurodiverse? And for example, and maybe I'm answering my own question, I've had clients that they need a sort of time out, like when it comes to sensory overload, let's say with sounds, okay? They would say, no, I don't need a hug. I don't need any of these things. I want to go in my room with my headphones and I just need an hour or so to myself and that's what I need. How would you interpret that from the needs point of view?
So I have some ideas. I don't think that I have a definitive answer. So what we're looking at is the unique differences for neurodivergent individuals, and that can mean things like sensory differences. So we have considered sensory safety as an additional need for some neurodivergent people. Another one would be self-regulation. So finding different ways, whether it's through movement or in that example, Rob, through withdrawal. So being able to, you know, kind of reduce sensory input and that sort of thing. We might consider that to be an additional need. Another need would be monotropic interests and hyperfocus. So amongst autistic individuals, we often see really intense passions or interests, which we sometimes call spins. And with ADHD, we see hyperfocus, where, you know, an individual can be intensely focused on a particular thing that has caught their attention for long periods of time. One of the things that we do actively is the adaptive value of those particular needs, I guess you would say. So what I mean by that is that when you allow a neurodivergent person to spend time hyper-focusing or intensely engaging in the thing that they're passionate about, that is a really significant contributor to their well-being. And again, in traditional psychotherapy models, it's overlooked, and we might
interesting
and certainly also in the past, we've often tried to train that out. You know, you should have more diverse interests. It's not healthy to only focus on one thing. And that is, I would say, definitively is incorrect.
That's what you find in your clients, that they, and this is a part of, I guess, the criteria for what is a core emotional need, or what is a core basic need, is that thwarting of access to that need creates distress. And access to the need creates well-being or associated with well-being. So from what you're saying, these things makes sense. It would probably meet the criteria for a need. So it's really important work you're doing, Alyssa, you know, thinking through all this stuff with your colleagues and How exciting.
Yeah, I would love to know a little bit about some anecdotes or some examples in your practice of how this approach has, you know, had a positive impact. And can you discuss any? Can you let us have a little snapshot how it has manifested in your
particularly
work?
This affirming piece, like, because we all know schema therapy is awesome, but this affirming piece, how has it made a difference for some of your clients?
So the short answer is, how does it make a difference? It makes a difference every day in every way. So this change of lens to a neurodiversity affirming lens changes everything every day in big ways and in small ways. Generally, what I would say is that what I love, what is such an immense privilege and joy as a therapist, is that with this change, my clients feel seen, they feel heard, and they feel understood, often for the first time. And what I'm aware of for myself, because, you know, following on from our earlier conversation about, well, aren't we all affirming? That
try to be
being affirming always been has always been a core value of me as a person, professional. So I've always made space for people to be as they are. But what I have noticed for long-term clients where I've always been affirming and now I'm neurodiversity affirming, is I have seen that change. And I have seen them unmask and be able to express themselves and use the therapy space in a way that makes sense to them. And you might be wondering, what does that look like? Are you interested?
Absolutely.
What that might look like?
Let's talk about it.
So one of the really common characteristics of autism and ADHD is masking. So masking is when you engage in behaviors, either consciously or unconsciously, that are intended to conceal neurodifferences. And we can very much expect that clients will come into our therapy room and they will mask, because that's the neurotypical advisor saying, you know, these are the norms and expectations, and there will be a coping mode that says it's not safe for you to unmask and be how you are. Changing the way that I approach my work in lots of different ways, I have seen clients relax. I have seen them move around the therapy room. I have seen them ask for things like, it's too bright in here, can you turn the lights off or, you know, it's too boring, or you're asking me open-ended questions and that's, I don't know how to answer them, can you be more specific? So they're asking for more things.
There's an extra level of safety. Look, you know, you're hoping that the room, and I guess this keeps on going back to this idea of attunement, you're being more attuned to the level of safety and the understanding of what that client needs, that it's different from your
own. So you're sort of tuning in, like schema therapy is already very attuned, but we're also tuning into these more specific needs of these folks. Yeah.
Yes. And so in being able to do that, What I'm really aware of is that what I've described sounds a lot to my ears like, that makes therapy nicer. It makes it nicer for me to be with the client, to be more connected, and it makes them happy to come and see me and that sort of thing. And that's all very well and good. But as evidence-based clinicians, we want to do way more than just feel good therapy. We want to see meaningful change. What I would say there is that those things that I've described in terms of the client feeling safe to unmask, they open the gateway for schema therapy to be effective in ways that it wasn't before. So, and what, if you're looking for a more kind of specific example, one of the things that I absolutely love, and I would say it's not universal, but it's very common in working with neurodivergent clients, is that perspective schema. And so within neuronormative schema therapy models, the way that I've thought to reparent that was sending that persistent message, there's nothing wrong with you, you are fine just the way that you are. And what I was finding with my neurodivergent clients is that doesn't land. Like they end up with saying things like, you know, thank you, and I believe that you've had, but I can't feel myself. I don't feel that there's nothing wrong. I feel like there is something wrong. So what we're doing with the neuroaffirming lens is we're changing the there's nothing wrong with you to there isn't anything wrong with you, but there is something different about you, and that is valid and important and something that we need to grow and nurture and understand.
Would you go as far as to say special?
Special.
Superpower.
Probably. Sometimes people can have very special abilities almost, you know, with some of these profiles. Like embracing,
yeah, absolutely.
Going to that point of even, yes, it's different, but it's also, it can be special in a way. I mean, it can be a superpower. Would you go that far? I mean, you wouldn't say it if it wasn't true.
So, it's a good question, and there's debate in the field as to whether that is helpful or not. It's certainly the case that for everybody, independent of neurotype, we have our profile, our strengths profile, things that we're particularly strong on and things that we're particularly weak on. Unless there was a good clinical reason, I would not be using that word special because I think the risk of it buying into the patronized
this connotation of you're special or something. Yeah, sure.
I mean, I remember.
So it's unlikely.
So it's risky and probably not worth the risk, what you're saying, yeah. But even if you didn't say that word.
What we really want to emphasize. Really want to emphasize valid difference.
Difference. Mm-hmm. Advantage? Did you say advantage?
No, I said valid difference.
Valid difference. Okay. You wouldn't say the superpower thing? No superpowers?
No. So, again, there is some debate, but most of the voices that I have tuned into argue against that for lots of different reasons, including buying into kind of special narrative, and also it can function to minimize or invalidate the daily struggles of neurodivergent.
Yeah, yeah. I have to ask though, and I know we're running out of time because you said something and it was about coping modes and we haven't gone there. Are there sort of, you know, diverse coping modes that we see in these clients that we don't see elsewhere? Like, do we have new modes?
Well, in the Stern-Attuned model, we consider coping modes in terms of masks. So thinking about muscles and experience, we look at the standard fight, flight, freeze coping modes in terms of how are they function to mask. That is something that is often helpful and applicable, but not always holding in our schema therapy framework. The thing that I would say about modes, and it also applies to schemas, is that as part of our assessment and intervention process, we're thinking really carefully about what is adaptive and what is maladaptive. And so, you know, within the schema therapy model, schema is short for early maladaptive schema, right? And then in our daily discussions, we often drop that maladaptive part and we just talk about the schema and the mode itself. What is really important to be looking at with neurodivergent clients is that behaviors and coping responses that may appear maladaptive could actually be serving an adaptive function, and we need to pay close attention to that. And so that's the job of the neurodivergent healthy adult, is to be discerning, okay, in this situation, is it adaptive coping or is it maladaptive coping?
Yeah. And but do you see more, you know, unique versions of coping that, you know, we wouldn't see typically with the coping modes? Do you see what I'm saying? When you say masking, for example, we don't have in the typical model a kind of masking mode. You know, I have seen, and I've noticed this in my own practice with neurodiverse clients. And then I saw later, I read some of the stuff that you guys were working on. I think there's something, you might have proposed something like a social overcompensator, for example. Is that something that's come up, like overcompensating in a social way?
I think Dave Edwards had mentioned something like a social overcompensator, and maybe it might link, but I don't know.
Is that something that you guys have proposed? I don't know where I read it now. Yeah.
That doesn't come specifically from us. Look, I wouldn't say that there are particular specific modes that I have seen come up more prominently. The work that we have done so far has tended to focus just much more directly on what is the function of this coping, which is what extent is it adaptive or maladaptive. So we see lots of surrender responses, lots of avoidant or detached coping. But again, what looks like maladaptive avoidance may actually be healthy coping. We need to keep that in mind, and same with detachment. And we also see those overcompensating, talking a lot or being the life of the party or over preparing for a job interview or whatever it might be. That may be something that comes, but it's not.
Yep. Well, Lissa, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on and hearing about all of your experience in neurodiverse practice and neurodiversity affirming practice. Absolute pleasure, and to hear your perspective, and I'm sure that other folks will be interested and inspire others to learn more about it. Well, thank you so much for coming on.
And when do we find out some more information about the standard tune model? Is there somewhere where people can go to, where we can point in their direction, your direction?
Yeah, so it's fairly early days, but we do have some upcoming training, should I give you the website for that?
Yeah, we could probably put it in the show notes at the bottom of the pod. So yeah, if you do that, we'll get that as a part of the
We have a webinar coming up on the 23rd of May, looking at the foundations of neurodiversity affirming practice as they relate to schema therapy. So that's our latest model. But stay tuned. You know, join our mailing list, because we have future webinars planned for later in the year, looking at how do we approach assessment and what actually looks different with our assessment and treatment process. And we offer supervision groups as well.
Yeah. So I'm assuming there's a website that they can be
You can go to, it's learn.standardtuned.com.au, and you can find more information on there. We also have a Facebook group, Neurodiversity Affirming Schema Therapists. You're welcome. One that's a peer-led group where we can share information and resources and ask questions and that sort of thing.
It's wonderful to see. You know, it's wonderful to see. You know, it's a similar sort of thing that Rob had a couple of weeks ago when we talked to an old supervisee, and seeing what you're doing, moving things forward and going to new areas that are so enriching for everyone else in schema therapy. So great, fantastic work. It's lovely to see you doing what you're doing and
taking the schema model into diverse areas. It's awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah.
Okay, Alyssa, we'll see you around the traps. Thanks for coming in on the pod. And that's enough from us for today. Thanks, everyone, for listening in.